This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, the home of the awful truth. We could talk about 500,000 more people kicked out of their jobs this month. The record number of regular mortgages 2 or 3 months behind, collapsing states, budget-slashing towns, bankrupt banks. But hey, why bother with all that bad news when the biggest story ever told is unfolding before our very eyes? I know disappearing coral, birds, and plants nobody has heard of. That doesn't sell. How about this? The food we all eat is under pressure even in these early days of climate change.
There have been very few studies of the scope for adaptation like that. And at this point, there's actually very little bit of work being done on adaptation, because I'm not aware of anybody who's systematically trying to grow crops which are likely to be successful in a much hotter, drier world. You'd think that would be happening, but it isn't, as far as I'm aware.
That is economist Dr. Jeffrey Heal speaking to the London School of Economics. He's going to tell us about agricultural loss already underway and projected in the coming decades. Why fertile California will take a hit. Did the oil and coal boys twist the Waxman-Markey climate and energy bill out of shape? Then food activist and author Wayne Roberts works through the challenge of feeding a world where nature is interrupted. Food and global warming in a speech recorded by Maggie Hughes. That's coming up. The wheat news is both good and bad. In the summer of 2009, wheat prices are going down because so many new acres have been planted. That doesn't mean it will all survive until the harvest, though. Canada is a big wheat producer, and the Canadian Wheat Board predicts a 20% crop loss due to a drought in Western Canada. Could it be climate change? It's the northern tip of a new dust bowl expected to fill the North American West as carbon levels rise in the atmosphere. Two other big wheat producers, China and Australia, are also in big trouble this year as rains stop reaching the fields. Did I mention the new unstoppable wheat disease called UG99? It was first found in Uganda, but has now spread to the Middle East, including Iran. The only response is to burn the crop. So far, we have no resistant varieties, and experts in both Europe and North America say they expect UG99 to arrive sooner rather than later. That could devastate wheat production. Maybe this year, maybe 3 years from now, wheat and bread products could rocket up in price or disappear for a while. That's when I'll crack open my buckets and make my own. On to the show. First of all, American climate politics. The U.S. Supreme Court recently gave the Environmental Protection Agency control over carbon dioxide as a pollutant. Why didn't the Obama administration use their green appointees to get busy on greenhouse gases through the EPA? Suddenly, a new piece of legislation appears in the House where political contributions reign. Suddenly, a bunch of Republicans vote for the Waxman-Markey bill. Let's get a different perspective from Dr. Jeffrey Heal, an economist from the Columbia Business School in New York. His speech on May 6, 2009, second-guessed the Obama energy deal and went on to explain why America has been hustled backwards on climate change. Then Heal, who has been working the connections between economy and the environment since 1979, paints a dire picture of agricultural losses, as high as 40% worldwide as the climate shifts to its new hot state.
Thanks. I'm Cameron Hepburn from the LSE in Oxford. Jeff, I was struck by the description of the United States as a petro-state. And I was wondering in that context, given that we've just seen that the Australians have delayed the introduction of their emissions trading scheme, whether the Waxman-Markey bill has any hope of getting up in the US and what that means for Copenhagen.
Cameron's question on the petro-state and the Dingell Boucher, there's two bills, there's the Waxman-Markey bill and the Dingell Boucher bill, and they're both similar. What are the chances of those going through Congress? Well, the dynamics of this was fundamentally changed recently. As you probably know, last year the Supreme Court, as a result of some cases which came up, from somewhere on the northeastern states, found that carbon dioxide is a pollutant in the terms of the 1973 Clean Air Act. So the 1973 Clean Air Act in the United States gives the Environmental Protection Agency powers to regulate the emission of a pollutant. So under those powers, it regulates the emission of SO2, NOx, and a whole bunch of things like that. Now, some states have claimed that CO2 was also a pollutant and the EPA should be regulating its emissions. Obviously, the Bush administration appealed. They won some initial court cases. The Bush administration appealed. It went all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, slightly surprisingly, found in favour and ruled that CO2 is a pollutant under the 1973 Clean Air Act. This gives the Environmental Protection Agency the right, if it thinks appropriate, to regulate the emission of CO2 without any further action on the part of Congress, which is actually a very important event. And the Environmental Protection Agency announced about 3 weeks ago that it intends to do that. So they put out a discussion document saying, you know, CO2 is a pollutant. We intend to regulate the emission of CO2 from all sources. Now, that's radically changed the whole congressional dynamics, because the fossil fuel industry is much more frightened of the EPA than it is of Congress. The EPA is likely to come up with some very stringent measures. The EPA, Obama's EPA is run by a bunch of environmentalists, and people are very worried about climate change. So if it's left to them, the U.S. will get a very, very strong environmental policy on CO2. So at this point, the fossil fuel lobby is actually trying to promote action in Congress of a type which would preempt action by the EPA. So what the fossil fuel lobby is working for is a weak Waxman-Markey bill, or a weak Dingell-Boucher bill, which would set standards which are lower than those that the EPA is likely to set on its own, and which would preempt action by the EPA. So it's not clear how things are going to evolve at this point. Two groups have just switched sides. The environmentalists were pressing for action in Congress, the coal lobby was pressing against action. Now that's switched completely. The environmentalists are now rather happy with the status quo, because they have an environmentalist running the EPA, and the Supreme Court has said she has the power to regulate CO2 emissions as a pollutant. The coal industry and the oil industry are obviously very unhappy with that. So it's not clear what's going to happen. It's a very interesting situation. But the fallback point, this is a bargaining game, and the fallback point has just been changed dramatically. In favour of the environmental groups. And so that is presumably going to change the bargain that emerges, and we all know from Nash bargaining theory. So my guess is that a year from now, the US will have a fairly aggressive CO2 policy. It may be that comes directly from the EPA, and it may be that's a result of congressional action. But I think with a significant majority in the House and potentially a blocking majority in the Senate, the Democrats will be able to insist on reasonably strong action. The one downside of this is that the EPA doesn't have the power to do something like introduce a cap-and-trade system or a uniform carbon tax. So anything that the EPA does is likely to be inefficient from an economic perspective. They're likely to regulate in much the same way as they've regulated automobile emissions. They're likely to put tailpipe standards on the emission of CO2 and emission limits on the standard emission of CO2 from power stations. And they're likely to do that in a way which doesn't actually permit one to equalize marginal costs across applications. So that actually could significantly increase the costs of dealing with climate change, as we know.
Why is the American government the last to know we need action to save the climate? Jeffrey Heal gives us three bad reasons in his speech as the first visiting professor at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics, the LSE. Here it is.
So there was a lot of controversy during the period during which that science settled down. And some of that controversy was real and genuine and necessary, and some of it was false. One of the interesting things when you look back on that controversy was the extent to which there was deliberate misrepresentation and intervention in the debate, in particular by entities like the Global Climate Coalition, which is an organization based in the US and funded by Exxon, the oil company, and by a number of big coal companies, not funded directly, but funded indirectly, some other indirect routes, which have recently been publicly identified. And they were attempting to generate uncertainty and make it appear that the science was weak when in fact it wasn't. And they were quite effective at doing that, I guess, as they managed to extend the period of debate on the validity of climate science by somewhere in the region of 5 to 10 years, quite a significant extension. And I was, something that really caught my attention the other day, about a week back, 10 days back, there was a piece in the New York Times, actually, about one of the people who was responsible for running the Global Climate Coalition. He'd been interviewed by the Times in the light of some revelations about the funding of the Global Climate Coalition and the role that various energy companies had played in supporting that. And he made the remarkable statement that we actually never thought that the debate about, we never thought that the science of climate change was wrong. We just wanted to make certain there was a proper public debate about it. It was a really striking and quite outrageous statement about it. Anyway, the debate about the science of climate change, I think, is now closed. But what is interesting, and I think the reason we're talking today, is that that debate has moved one stage. And the debate is now about the economics of climate change. So there are people who are saying, OK, we agree with you, climate change is real, it's happening, so we don't dispute the science. But let's talk about the economics of climate change. Stopping climate change is expensive, it's costly, we're in a recession, it's something we can't really afford. So although there may be some validity to the science on climate change, we've got to look at the economics of this carefully. And the economics suggest this is something we can't deal with. It's not appropriate to deal with. So that's really what I want to talk about and what many people who work on the economics of climate change are concerned with. Before I do that, I want to just make a few remarks about why there has been so much very, very strong opposition to the reality of climate change and to the adoption of policies on climate change in the United States. And obviously, the United States is clearly in a different category from Europe when it comes to climate change. There's really sort of strong, almost atavistic opposition to the idea that climate change is real, to the idea that we need to take action on climate change in some still quite influential circles in the US. And there's nothing quite equivalent to that in this country or in Western Europe. And I'm not certain I fully understand still why that is, but I've got some suggestions which I just want to share with you briefly, and I'd be interested to get your comments on them afterwards. One thing which I think relatively few people understand outside of the US, and indeed relatively few even in the US, is that the US is a major petrostate. If I talk to you about a petrostate, you think I'm talking about Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, something like that. The US is actually a major petrostate. The US is the third largest producer of oil in the world. Biggest producer is Saudi Arabia, produces about 9 billion barrels a day. Second and third are Russia and America, producing both about 7 million barrels a day. The fourth biggest producer in the world is Kuwait, and it's down there at about 3.5 million barrels a day. So, Russia, the US, and Saudi Arabia dominate the world oil market. You don't think of the US as a major oil producer, but it is. The US is also the second largest producer of coal in the world, after China, and has the largest coal reserves in the world. It's also the second largest producer of natural gas in the world. So the US really is a major producer of fossil fuels. When you add together its positions in coal, oil, and gas, the US is actually the largest producer of fossil energy in the world by quite a large margin. So that, I think, perhaps gives you some perspective into one of the sources of opposition to the reality of climate change in the US context. The fossil fuel lobby in the United States is uniquely influential and uniquely powerful. I mean, you can see this very clearly in the Bush regime. It was clear that both oil and coal industry had enormously close access, enormously open access to all members of the administration. And indeed, many lobbyists for both oil and coal were appointed to quite influential positions within things like the Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration. And that's a reflection of the power that the fossil fuel lobby has traditionally had. There's nothing new about this traditional power that the fossil fuel industry has had in the United States. And of course, they're the people who stand to lose most financially and economically from action on climate change. So it's understandable that they are using that considerable lobbying power to oppose action on climate change and to generate disbelief about the need for action on climate change. Now, in addition to that, there's a couple of other points I think are worth mentioning here. One is that in the US, you still have quite a large group of what I would call Reagan-Thatcher conservatives, people who believe, to quote Reagan, that government is the problem and not the solution, people who believe in unadulterated free markets and absolutely minimal role for government in the state. And if you hold that position, it's actually very difficult to reconcile that position with recognizing the reality of climate change, or indeed any environmental problem. Because climate change obviously is caused by the free operation of markets. It's a market failure. It's a massive market failure in economic terms. So if you're someone who really believes profoundly that free markets get it right, then you can't combine that with a recognition of the reality of climate change. It's a kind of a cognitive dissonance that's going to arise in that context. So free market conservatives downplay climate change and downplay the need for government intervention here. And free market conservatives are still much more influential in the US than they are in Western Europe. We don't really have, there was a group of people like that who were influential under the Thatcher regime in this country, but the influence of that group has died away to a much greater extent than it has in the US. Obviously, it's no longer dominant in the US, as you can see from the last election, but it's still quite influential, particularly amongst Republican senators. And they constitute an important group here. A final comment on this, which I think is interesting, and again, something which is important in the US and has no analogy over here, is that it's quite an influential group of what you call religious conservatives in the US. There's no parallel to this group, really, in Western Europe. This is a group of people who actually believe that the Bible is the gospel truth. They believe you have to take the Bible literally. And there are significant senators and congressmen who actually believe this. It's difficult to see that sometimes from a Western European perspective, but it's true. These people are actually very hostile to much of modern science. I mean, they're hostile to the theory of evolution. They're hostile to the theories of planetary formation and planetary evolution because they undermine the beliefs that they choose to hold in respect to the origin of species and the origins of the world. And people like this are hostile to much modern science and skeptical about much modern science. And again, they're hostile to climate change and the theories of climate change for the same sorts of reasons. Their hostility to modern science carries over. And again, many people like this were appointed to important positions in the Bush regime. Something which has been very well documented. So there's aspects of the US sort of political environment which are radically different from anything we have over here, and which I think are responsible for the very strong opposition that there has been and actually continues to be to accepting the reality of climate change, to accepting the need for action on climate change, and to putting those actions into place.
There you have it. Fossil fuel corporations fought to cloud our minds, aided by a history of conservatism and anti-scientific religious interests. I think he could have added all of us as well. We love our big cars and leaving all the lights on. We love to fly around for holidays while eating far too much. We're all in this climate tragedy together. Never forget the power of the people to empower a wrong-headed civilization, on our charge cards no less. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm hungry to get on to our next main topic for this program, how climate change will affect our dinner plates. Here is more from Dr. Jeffrey Heal from his speech, Controversies in the Economics of Climate Change.
I mentioned the loss of agricultural land. A surprising fraction of the world's agricultural land is within a few feet of sea level. About a billion and a half people live within 10 feet of sea level. So again, there's modest rises in sea level, are very far-reaching consequences there. Would displace very large numbers of people. So those are some consequences of sea level, potentially very, very significant. And from an economic perspective, these are some of the easier things to deal with. Now, we can work out what are the costs of loss of infrastructure, what are the costs of the loss of agricultural land, and so on. So these are relatively easy to deal with. Let me talk next about the impact of climate change on agriculture. It will, of course, mean increasing frequency of droughts. There's a couple of studies, actually a growing number of studies, of the impact of climate change on agricultural productivity. One of the most interesting ones, I think one of the most thorough ones, is a paper by some guys called Schlenker, Hanneman, and Fisher, published in the American Economic Review a couple of years ago, which suggests that on a business-as-usual scenario, in other words, if we make no effort at all to curb climate change, let things go ahead as they are on present trends, then U.S. agricultural output, which incidentally is 25% of world agricultural output. I mean, the US produces 25% of all the food produced in the world, believe it or not. US agricultural output could drop by between 50 and 70% by 2100. That's a really dramatic drop. 50% drop in US agricultural output is a 12.5% drop in world agricultural output. That's very significant indeed. There have been similar studies recently carried out for India, China, and Africa, by a number of authors, including Bill Klein in Washington, by the World Bank and others. And they find that for those countries, you know, the same set of assumptions, business as usual scenario from the IPCC, agricultural output would drop by somewhere between 30 and 40% by 2100. And all of this, incidentally, is making one rather positive, rather favorable assumption, which is that climate change brings no change in the availability of water for agriculture. So that all these consequences for climate change are consequences that just come from the heat stress that plants are subject to. And the real reason for these impacts here is that plants show a very non-linear response to changes in temperature. Now, as temperatures increase up to a certain point, plant productivity increases and plant growth increases, then flattens out, and as the temperature crosses about a threshold of around about 32 degrees centigrade, plant growth just stops and plants die very quickly. So that's the principal reason behind these dramatic figures here, is that large parts of the world agricultural territories will be subject to temperatures in excess of 32 degrees centigrade by 2100. So on that assumption, and without any assumption at all about the availability of water, we get these rather dramatic results about the impact of climate change on food supplies. Now, I'll show you later on estimates that suggest that the impact of climate change on water availability could also be quite dramatic. And there could be some far-reaching impact of climate change on water availability, which have a separate and independent impact on agricultural productivity worldwide. So anyway, we're talking here about potentially a drop of 40 to 50% in world food production by the end of the century. And let me just remind you that most demographers are forecasting that over this period of time, the world population will increase from 6 billion at the moment to around about 9 billion. So we're talking about a dramatic drop in food availability coupled with a significant increase in population over the next four, five, six decades. Last of these sort of market-type responses I want to talk about is the impact of climate change on the world's hydrological systems. Let me just tell you a little bit about this, and particularly give you an example based on the story in California. So California is one of the most productive agricultural states in the United States. It's a really major food-producing region. It produces a huge amount of very high-value food. Now, there are areas where the food is grown in California. It doesn't rain, ever. And in fact, it doesn't rain much in any parts of California. But there's a lot of precipitation, and it falls as snow in the winter. And it falls as snow in the mountains of California in the north and east. And then you get into during the winter, you get heavy snowfall in the northeast of California. It builds up in the mountains. You get snowpack there. And then what happens is that during the late spring and summer, that snowpack melts. It flows down the streams and provides irrigation for the very hot, arid regions in central and southern California. And so there's almost all of the water that's used for irrigation in the agricultural areas of California comes from the mountains in the northeast, and it comes from the melting snow. Now, as the climate is warming, what's happening is you're getting the same amount of precipitation in the northeast of California, but more of it is falling as rain and less of it is falling as snow. And when the rain falls, it doesn't stay in the mountains. It just falls straight down, comes straight down the streams. So what you're getting is stream flow in the winter rather than in the summer. And if you extrapolate this process far enough, you get to come to a point where there is very little snow at all. There's little snowpack in the mountains. And all of the precipitation will fall in the winter as rain and will run down the rivers in the winter. And there'll be nothing left in the rivers in the summer. So you'll get the same amount of flow in the rivers, but the timing will change. And the flow will be in the winter and the spring, and not in the summer. But the summer is when it's actually needed from an agricultural perspective. The impact on this in agriculture could be quite far-reaching. The same thing is happening in the Andes. And all of agricultural regions in South America are irrigated by a mixture of snow melt and glacier melt from the Andes. And again, there's a lot of evidence that water is the timing of that flow is significantly different. The glacial melt is much less because the glaciers have retreated, and the snow melt is less because there's less snow and more rain. And the same thing happens in the Tibetan Plateau. Tibetan Plateau actually is worth talking about more. It's a map of the Tibetan Plateau. You possibly can't read very clearly, but there's a number of very major rivers that originate in the Tibetan Plateau. I'll list them in a later slide. And these rivers are fed, again, by snowmelt from the Tibetan Plateau. You get heavy snow on the Tibetan Plateau in winter. Spring and summer, it melts. That water flows down those rivers and provides most of the irrigation for the Indian subcontinent and for Southeast Asia. Very, very important indeed. That's actually a picture of the Tibetan Plateau from a satellite, in fact. And this here, just for your amusement, is Mount Everest. It's from a US satellite looking south over the Tibetan Plateau. So these are some of the rivers that take off from the Tibetan Plateau. The Indus, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Yellow River, the Yangtze, and the Mekong. And there's also a number of smaller rivers that are all fed by melting snow from the Tibetan Plateau. And they provide the bulk of the irrigation for agriculture for several billion people who live in the Indian subcontinent, China, and other parts of Southeast Asia. So if you get a situation where the precipitation on the Tibetan Plateau changes from principally snow to principally rain, then have a profound and far-reaching impact on agriculture in Southeast Asia. And the consequences are really quite dramatic. You'll find that the total flow over the course of a year in these rivers could be the same, but much of the flow will be earlier in the year, in the winter and the spring, much less in the summer. And the summer is typically when this flow is actually needed for agricultural purposes. And this is an impact on agriculture over and above the impact from temperature increase that I mentioned earlier on. So there's two separate hits on agriculture as a result. One as a result of temperature rise, second as a result of potential changes to the hydrological cycle. And nobody's actually quantified the likely impacts of this change in the hydrological cycle on agriculture.
Finally, Dr. Heal wrestles with the economic cost of mass extinction. Sad but true, we need to enter this fact into the company books. Up to 40% of all species on Earth could go extinct by 2100. How will that affect sales, you ask? Jeffrey Heal is not your standard corporate accountant. He knows extinctions impact the environment in many strange ways. Take the Pacific sea otter, for example. It was almost wiped out in California, and what happened? The fisheries also died off that coast. It turns out the sea otters are keystone species. The otters were eating other creatures that kept things in balance for fish. When sea otters from Oregon were brought back down to California, the local fishing improved. Other connections between the species are harder to see. Let's hear Dr. Heal explain how the extinction of passenger pigeons may have boosted Lyme disease in the United States.
One of the remarkable predictions that the IPCC's last report makes, one which really didn't get a lot of attention, but I think is in many ways quite dramatic, is that, you know, on a business-as-usual scenario, by the end of the century, something like 30 to 40% of all known species, that's plants, animals, and insects, could be extinct as a result of climate change. Now, we know of, you know, probably of the order of 10 million species. So that's a forecast that, you know, 3 to 4 million species might actually go extinct by the end of this century or early next century because of climate change. That's a total transformation of the natural world around us, total transformation of the natural world around us. And a question that, you know, we have to ask in trying to assess the economics and the social consequences of climate change, does that matter? Would it matter to us that, you know, millions of species go extinct because of the way we're using energy and because of the lifestyles that we've adapted? And that's a tough question to answer. And here's some icons of extinction. The one that I'm sure you've all heard about is likely to go extinct because of climate change is the polar bear. They're shown having a hard time making his way about between crumbling ice flows. Here's one which you've probably heard less about, bees. Lots of insect populations are going extinct. In particular, bee populations are going extinct. That actually has some surprising and quite significant economic consequences. Now, the issue of extinction raises complicated questions. I mean, so as I see it, it raises two types of questions. There are ethical questions, and there are kind of practical utilitarian questions. Now, the ethical question, obviously, is do we have the right to condemn to extinction almost half of the species with which we share the Earth? There's a moral question, I think, involved in driving so many species to extinction. Do we have the right to do that? Because that's what we are, in effect, doing. Then the practical question, the utilitarian question, is will the extinction of so many of our fellow species actually affect us negatively? And that's a utilitarian question, leaving the ethical issue on one side. Now, the ethical question, I think, you guys have to judge for yourselves. It's a question of your own personal values and your own personal value system. To me, the answer is obviously no. This is not something we should allow to happen. I mean, I think there's some intrinsic value in any forms of life. And I don't think we have the right to condemn these species to extinction. But that's obviously a personal value judgment. You don't absolutely have to agree with that. And interestingly enough, religious groups, including some of the religious right in the United States, whom I was referring to earlier, are actually now beginning to get worried about this. I was recently shared a platform with a gentleman called Richard Cizik, who's one of the leaders of the Southern Baptist churches in the U.S. And those are the people I was talking to earlier who believe that the Bible is literally true and that we're profoundly hostile to the theory of evolution. But they are now getting worried about species extinction. And, you know, they feel that we have some sort of stewardship responsibilities to other species. So they're beginning to feel some ambivalence about the climate change issue because of this. And that's, I think, to me, an interesting development, political development. Now, it's hard to... I said species extinction raises two questions, right? The ethical question and the utilitarian question. The ethical question, as I said, is ultimately up to you to answer for yourselves. Utilitarian question is also quite a tough question to answer, because we don't really have the data that we need on this. But I'm going to suggest to you that probably the extinction of species does matter to us. But biologists certainly argue that it does. A lot of biological literature suggests that, you know, the extinction of other species may threaten the viability of our own species. There's a nice quote from a guy called Ed Wilson, who's a very distinguished biologist at Harvard, who spent most of his life studying insects. And he says, we need them, but they don't need us. We need them. Why do we need them? Well, we need them, for example, I had a picture of a bee up a couple of minutes earlier. Bees are insects. They're certainly going extinct at a fairly rapid rate at the moment. Now, you probably remember when you were kids stories about the birds and the bees and pollination. Bees actually play an important role in pollinating. And a lot of food wouldn't exist if it weren't pollinated by insects. Most of the large-scale crops, most of the large-scale grain crops, have been genetically modified so they don't need pollination. They self-pollinate. They're hermaphrodites, I guess you might say. But fruit and vegetables need pollination, and they need pollination by insects. And in areas where insect populations have crashed, the yield of fruit and vegetables has also crashed. That's happened in particular in New York State, my home. New York is known as the Big Apple. It's known as the Big Apple because apple growing is a major activity in the agricultural regions of New York. And the apple yields in New York State have crashed recently because the bee populations have crashed. And the apple blossoms haven't been fertilized, haven't been pollinated by insects. So the lack of insects, believe it or not, has a real economic cost. It's difficult to know precisely what that is on a global scale, but it's clear that it's real. And it's another sort of blow at our agricultural systems, potentially. What about other species? So that beast up there, believe it, that's not a cuddly toy. That's a Pacific sea otter. A Pacific sea otter is what biologists call a keystone species. A keystone species is a species with the following property. If you pull it out of an ecosystem, the equilibrium of the ecosystem changes radically. The behavior of the ecosystem really changes quite radically. So in this particular case, the Pacific sea otter was a keystone species for the marine ecosystems off the coast of California. Pacific sea otter obviously has nice fur on it, and it was hunted to extinction. And the last ones were killed sometime early in the 20th century. Now, prior to that, the coastal waters off California were very productive fisheries. The demise of the sea otter, the extinction of the sea otter there, led to a radical change in the marine ecosystems. And they became vastly less productive as fisheries and much, much less useful to human beings. Why? Because the principal food of the Pacific sea otter is the sea urchin. They control the population of sea urchins. They dive for sea urchins, they bring them up, they break them with rocks, and they eat the contents. You must have seen pictures of that on Nature and things of that sort. So when Pacific sea otters went extinct, the population of sea urchins exploded. Sea urchins are very destructive in a number of ways. And it's the growth in the population of sea urchins that led to the rapid decrease in the productivity of marine ecosystems off the coast of California. Now, this particular story has a happy ending, because there were some Pacific sea otters left in Oregon, up north of California, and they were brought back down. They were brought down to California. Legislation was passed protecting them, and protecting them from furriers. And the population of Pacific sea otters has now been reestablished, and the fisheries off the coast of California are once again productive fisheries. But then it's an example of how the pulling one species out of a complex ecosystem radically changed the value of that ecosystem to humans, transformed it from quite a valuable, productive ecosystem from which a lot of people could make their living to a totally unproductive ecosystem. Here's another example of the somewhat unexpected consequences of extinction. So that's a thing called the passenger pigeon. Passenger pigeons were once probably the most numerous birds in the world. They were unique to North America, and their population in North America was estimated to be in the range of billions, with a B. In fact, early settlers in North America commented on the size of the flocks of passenger pigeons. Passenger pigeons used to move around in flocks which contained over 1 million individuals per flock. And some of the early settlers have reports of the sky being darkened for 10 or 20 minutes as flocks of passenger pigeons flew overhead. The last passenger pigeon died in about 1915. They're now completely extinct. A couple of lessons from this. One is that even a remarkably robust animal with a huge population can be driven to extinction if it's hunted without limit and if its habitat is destroyed, which are the two factors that destroy the passenger pigeons. But more interestingly, in some sense, is the fact that people now associate the outbreak of a disease called Lyme disease with the demise of the passenger pigeon. Lyme disease is a very unpleasant tick-borne disease, which is the scourge of large parts of Northeast America. If you live in New York City and you have a country home up in the Connecticut or New York State or Massachusetts, then one of the things that bugs you all summer is the worry that you'll be bitten by ticks and you will get Lyme disease. Lyme disease is both an unpleasant disease and potentially a fatal disease. In fact, one of my neighbors in New York recently died of Lyme disease. So this is a serious disease. and it has a real consequence. Now, for a long time, people didn't associate the ending of the passenger pigeon population with Lyme disease, but about 12 years ago, a series of articles appeared in Science suggesting a link between the demise of the passenger pigeon and the outbreaks of Lyme disease, which appeared within about 4 or 5 years after the last passenger pigeon died. And the connection there, again, is a long and complicated one, but just giving you a real brief summary. Passenger pigeons ate acorns from oak trees. Much of the land in the Northeast America was covered with oak forests, and these birds ate the acorns from oak trees in very large scale. Once the population of passenger pigeons was destroyed, then there were many, many acorns available for other species that use acorns as their principal food. And in particular, deer and mice eat acorns. And the populations of both deer and mice exploded after the demise of the passenger pigeon, because there was much less competition now for the food, for their principal food, acorns. Now, both deer and mice are hosts for the tick that carries Lyme disease, and the tick whose bite gives Lyme disease. So with an explosion in the population of deer and mice, you get an explosion in the hosts of the ticks for Lyme disease, an explosion in the population of the ticks that make Lyme disease possible. And it's at that point that Lyme disease started being transferred to humans, because deer and mice obviously interact with human populations. So that's an interesting example of a totally unexpected consequence, and rather negative consequence for humans, of the extinction of a particular species. You know, ex ante, if you'd asked me, you know, whether there would be any consequence, any economic consequence of the extinction of a bird like the passenger pigeon, I'd have said, no, it would be a great pity if it went extinct, but I can't see any possible economic consequences of that. Turns out there probably have been some quite far-reaching, quite serious consequences. So I give you these examples just to suggest that although we don't really understand much about extinction and whether extinction will matter to us or not, there are enough examples to suggest that we should be very cautious. You know, if the IPCC is correct, if business as usual will lead to the extinction of literally millions of species by the end of this century, and just a few of those are Pacific sea otters or passenger pigeons or whatever, then the consequences could be quite serious and quite nasty.
That was Dr. Jeffrey Heal from the Columbia School of Business speaking on controversies in the economics of climate change. This presentation was at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics in Britain, May 6, 2009. Audio enhancement by Carl Hartung and Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find the full 55-minute speech plus Q&A on our climate pages at www.ecoshock.com.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex, and we're talking about climate disruption of the food supply.
There's a power of symbolism and inspiration, because the thing about food is that if you want to change, you can.
That's author and food activist Wayne Roberts, currently employed as a sustainable food advisor for the City of Toronto, Canada. He spoke at McMaster University in Hamilton on May 5, 2009, on food and climate change. Here is the first part of that speech by Wayne Roberts.
The relationship between food and global warming is just starting to come onto the radar of most people in the last year or so. And it's not only people who are global warming deniers who didn't look for a relationship between food and global warming. The people in the International Panel for Climate Change, who really concluded the debate about global warming, make no reference to agriculture. It's the one area in which they have no recommendations for action in the future. And most environmental groups, at least the ones that I've been familiar with, have had very little to say about food. They talk a lot about transportation, a lot about heat and home insulation and the like, but food has really only come on to the agenda in the past few years. So we got a lot of mileage to travel, politically speaking, not necessarily food mile speaking, to try to make up for some lost time. And as Karen pointed out, the general estimate is that about one-third of global warming emissions come from the food system, taken from beginning to end, or as it's sometimes referred to as from farm to fart. And that is including everything from seeding, fertilizing, producing the food, shipping it, processing it, distributing it, keeping it refrigerated, heating it to eat, putting it in the garbage can and having the garbage can taken somewhere, and all the different contents of the garbage can taken someplace different. So you put that all together, that's one-third of the global warming emissions. And I think the interesting thing about it is that it's humongous as a problem. It's also the most hopeful problem that we face, because what makes food different from other areas where there are pollution or global warming issues involved is that with food, you can not only reduce the damage you can do, that is, you can reduce the amount of plastic you can use, you can reduce the amount of refrigeration, but you're still going to cause some harm in either case. But with food, you can actually move over from the harm to the positive side of the ledger. You can actually, I don't think you can reverse global warming, but you can neutralize it. And so it's one of the few areas in life where we have a chance to really make a significant contribution, not only to reduce harm, but to do something very positive. And so it's regrettable that we're a bit late in getting to food. So what I'd like to do is to introduce you a bit to a methodology about looking at food and global warming. And I hope if you think about it, you would find it with the same methodology might help you understand food and obesity, or food and hunger, or food and economic development, food and job creation, food and ending the recession. If you look at the four key points that I'm going to try to make, I think the same method, not the same information, but the same method would apply to any food problem that you want to think about. My first point about food is that whatever you say about food, it is going to have a big impact. Food is the biggest polluter in the world. It is the biggest employer in the world. It is the biggest employer of child labor in the world. It is also, on the positive side, it is the biggest source of job creation, of new jobs, of jobs for young people. And it is also the biggest potential solar industry in the world. And when we think about solar industries, we're usually thinking of, you know, photovoltaics or something that's going to produce electricity. We don't think that farming was, of course, the quintessential solar industry for many tens of thousands of years. The reason why the impact of food is so huge is that we have a little over 6 billion people in the world, rapidly going towards 9 billion people a year. So if we take it from today's numbers of about 6, and you think of the number of people who only eat one meal a day, which would be about 800 million people, almost a seventh of the world's population. And then there are 1.6 billion people, that is double the number of people who go hungry, who are overweight or obese, and that is they're eating approximately four or five meals, the equivalent of four or five meals a day. So basically you can say everybody, in the average number in the world is three meals a day times 6 billion times 365 days in the year. You multiply those figures out, it's always going to be a big number, whatever way you want to look at it. So that's what makes food so different from other things, is that its impact is just multiplied so many times in so many places every day. One of the areas where this shows up, of course, is in waste. Food waste, the numbers on it are humongous. We can take an extrapolation of what Hamilton's numbers would be from Toronto, I think. So in Toronto, we throw away 1 million coffee cups a day. We throw away 1 million plastic water bottles a day. And I'm assuming that the ratios are probably not any different here. In Ontario, we use 4 billion plastic shopping bags a year that go into the garbage. So just think of if everyone used disposable chopsticks, how many forests are eliminated. So the numbers with food are always huge, and that includes in the field of waste. Again, show the flip side, because this is what I'm interested in, is the power to do harm and the power to do good, which is inherent in food, that we have that choice. I got a call from somebody when I put up on my Facebook site. My daughter put me up on a Facebook site. I became a Facebook enthusiast, and I was happy to hear that Karen took my advice and went on to a Facebook herself. I joined this group to ban the plastic bag in Ontario, and I got a email from a guy who runs a small food box company in Vancouver, which is part of the wonder of modern technology. And he said that in his company, they'd made a move to eliminate plastic bags, and that in his company alone, called Small Potatoes, just a small local delivery operation for local food, they'd eliminated 3 million bags in a year. So one side, 4 billion bags, but the other, one little company with maybe 300-400 customers, and they're eliminating in the area of 3 million plastic bags a year. Our food travels on average, if you take the milk, the cereal, the coffee, the sugar, the banana that you have for breakfast, and you calculate how many miles each molecule of that food traveled, on average, any day, your average molecule has traveled 2,000 miles, which is the basis of an unsustainable food system. There is more energy involved in transporting the food than there is in the food. The food spends longer in a truck than it does in your digestive tract. Not good indicators of a healthy food system. And what makes that possible is packaging for long-distance travel. So we may commute a fair distance. Some of you may even commute from Hamilton to Toronto to work, but your packages commute even further, and they commute even further than the food, because the plastic carton on your organic lettuce from California may start off in Calgary, go down to California, come to the food terminal in Ontario, and then be shipped over, as about 20% of the plastic that is picked up in Toronto is shipped to China to be recycled. So it's much more than 2,000 kilometers. One of the facts that we'll be taking a look at is that meat, which is implicated in global warming in a number of ways, and I'll point out later that you don't have to be a vegetarian as a result of the information that I'm going to share with you, but you will probably see your way to reducing the amount of meat that you consume. We are a meataholic society. We eat approximately twice as much meat as we need, even if you think we need meat. In terms of our protein and other needs, and it's a very expensive method to obtain protein and other nutrients. And one of the things that is linked with the modern food system is how it made meat, which is traditionally an extremely expensive food to produce. That's why in most food systems, like you had the vegetarian faux restaurant in Susie's File, they would use meat as a flavoring for a soup. It was not a main course. It was not the center of the plate, which is what it has become since the 1970s with the rise of McDonald's. And what McDonald's and the fast food industry have succeeded in doing, which has never been done in history before, is to make meat a cheap food. And so that's one of the themes that we need to take into account, is that cheap food has, since the 1970s, and most of the problems that are coming from the food system, the enormous meta problems, to use the phrase, I think, from Karen, is come from the 1970s. There have always been problems with food, but never the meta-embedded ones we've had since the 1970s. In terms of big, there's a big number of people who are employed in the food industry, about 2 billion around the world who are associated with it. There's a huge number of consumers, over 6 billion. They're, ironically, despite the huge number of food producers and the huge number of food customers, there's a very small number of corporations which call the shots. In almost any industry that you care, any sector of the industry you care to look at, there are 4, 5, most 10 companies that dominate the entire sector. 4 companies buy about 90% of the coffee. 3 companies buy about the same percentage of the wheat. So it's an incredibly monopolized and centralized industry. Cargill is one of them. It's a privately owned company about which very little is known. And basically, people who analyze the food system talk about the hourglass, and that the large corporations move into the center of the hourglass. They take that big funnel of farmers, and then there's that big funnel of, or big pool of consumers at the end, and they are right there at the choke points of the system. And where they gather is at the center of major distribution points. So these are huge companies that have a vested interest in a long-distance food system. So here they have Cargill in the Mississippi River, and Bunge, an equally big company, again, focusing on that sort of central choke point between the farmer and the consumer. Among the giants, I think almost everyone has heard of Burger King and McDonald's, but you may not have heard of the names of Sodexo. Anyone heard of Sodexo? Compass, Chartwell, or Aramark. These are companies that have approximately 500,000 employees each around the world, and that literally dominate this food service industry. I don't know who has the contract here at McMaster, but I'd almost bet a lot of money that one of those companies that I just named has it. The only university in Canada that has an independent, that is self-operated company is Guelph University. So almost by sheer deduction, if that's the only one, I'm pretty sure McMaster does not have one. So, and again, these are hugely centralized operations. And this is an interesting irony of the food system, which again connects to this power to do good or the power to not do good. And that is the reason why these food service companies have the power they do is that in most of the institutions they serve have another cause for being. That is, a university, the focus of the university is on teaching. The focus of a hospital is on operating. And food is a number two. They don't want to deal with those headaches, and so they farm it out. So because they don't regard food as an important part of the university experience, even though that's where students spend an enormous amount of time hanging out, and because food is not considered an important part of the hospital experience, even though we have lots of evidence on how it can help the rate of recovery from an operation, they always farm it out. But all it takes in order to stop the farming out is for people to say, hey, wait a minute, this is too important to contract out. That the way our food system operates is key to the kind of spirit that we want to develop at McMaster. And so we're going to have our own that responds to our needs and not somebody else's. And bingo, it's changed. So this is the miraculous power that exists to transform, which does not exist, I would argue, in the same way in other sectors. Again, on the big sign, and Walmart, of course, is a big operator. Approximately 2% of the North American gross domestic product is controlled by this one firm. When one firm controls 2% of your gross domestic product, that's not a sign of economic health or even distribution. But in terms of cities, and this is just starting to dawn on city planners, that they're beginning to see that food is an important contributor to the shape of the city. We now know that approximately 20% of the miles that are driven within a city are to buy food. That's because more and more food stores are not centered near the neighborhood, but are out in a suburban mall that require a car to get to, and sometimes a car to get around inside, or some kind of cart. And so Walmart is part of that incredible increase in the number of car miles. And so when you think about the cost of something that is low cost in a Walmart, you have to think that part of that cost is 20% of the car miles driven in the city, 20% of the road repair, 20% of a whole bunch of other things that are associated with it. So again, just to the point of the hugeness of the biggest user by far of water in the world is food. So, you know, if you think in terms of the normal environmental imagination, we think of logging firms, car producers, steel plants as the dirty polluters and the big consumers of product. But in fact, agriculture is always way over and beyond them. So it is the number one user of water, the number one polluter of water in the world. And it's now led to the concept which people are talking about as either embedded water or virtual water. That is, in any given day, you consume about 2,000 times more water in the food that you eat than in the water you drink. Food is, of course, you can't grow food without water. Different kinds of foods require different amounts of water. Low, relatively speaking, for vegetables and grains. High, relatively, for meat. So, again, we're getting into this big thing. And, of course, when it's big, as you can see here, it has to be transported from someplace else, perhaps up a mountain. So that all takes energy, and again, that's all related to global warming. Food is also the largest cause of deforestation. Okay, not the logging industry, not the lumber industry, but the agricultural industry. This is a picture of Brazil and the rainforest, which is being chopped down literally as we sit here to make room for cattle and for soy. It's also the biggest employer of child labor. And again, just to show you the flip side, some of you may have heard of this group of tomato pickers in the United States called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who work in the northern Florida area. And a few years ago, they launched a boycott against Taco Bell, saying that they should pay an increase in the price of tomatoes that would go to the workers who picked the tomatoes, who were generally judged to live in slave-like conditions. And what they asked Taco Bell was to pay 1.5 cents per pound more for their tomatoes. And after a reasonably short boycott of several months, Taco Bell gave in, and they were quickly followed by Burger King and McDonald's. And just last week, Bon Appetit, which is owned by Compass Food in Canada, did the same in the U.S. for their U.S. campuses, a mood which might even extend to Canada someday, who knows. By increasing the price by 1.5 cents per pound, they improved the living conditions of the tomato workers by 70%. Okay, so in other words, one of the things that goes with the big of food is that a very small difference can have a huge impact. So that, to my last point under the big theme, which is use your head and think strategically, and we can do something. Now, when you buy the book from Brian Prince, the No-Nonsense Guide to World Food, you will see that the opening chapter is called I Think, Therefore I Can, which is a little play on a famous statement by Descartes. And Obama stole that line from me and formed his own slogan, Yes, We Can. Same principle.
You have been listening to Wayne Roberts, a longtime food activist, making the connections between the polluted environment and climate change. This talk at McMaster University in Canada was part of a college radio program called The Other Side of the News on CFMU-FM. Producer Maggie Hughes just announced she had to give up her weekly radio program for health reasons. But she'll continue to get the facts others miss in specials posted on the audio-enhanced website called radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. For indie producer Maggie Hughes' past work and coming shows. Thanks, Maggie. Or check out her website at www.oside.ca. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Find the full speeches by Dr. Jeffrey Heal and Wayne Roberts as free MP3 downloads on our website. Choose Climate from our Audio On Demand menu lower down on the main page at ecoshock.org. This is the last show of our 2009 spring season. Rebroadcasting stations, podcast listeners, and regular downloaders, please note, I've laid out 8 key reruns of the Radio EcoShock show for the summer. These are on our archive page. You can find them there, or you can find them at ecoshock.net. These are the most important and most downloaded programs we've ever done. Load up your iPod, MP3 player, or computer with hot programs and speeches from EcoShock. It takes a lot to really grasp this developing storm in your heart. So I'll have those 8 key reruns ready for you by Wednesday, July 8th, up on our website. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for being on the journey with me. I'll be back in a whole new season, 48 new Radio EcoShock shows starting in late August, and I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about as this all goes forward. Have a great summer, enjoy yourself, and put away the harvest as it comes.
What's the point coming all this way, making deserts in a day? What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day? Someone out there's playing a deadly game, cutting down a wounded land in pain. There's a hole in the sky where the sun gets through, burning every which way, from the top to the bottom of the food chain to in the middle of the desolate plain. What's the point coming all this way, making deserts in a day, making deserts in a day? What's the use, Mother Nature say, making deserts in a day, making deserts in a day? Sound of the wind and weeping rain, crying out, it will never be the same. There's a life. the size of a grain of sand, dying.